This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
I am delighted to report that Dr. Heather Lynn is back with us after almost exactly a year. When we talked last, we talked about evil archaeology, and it was one doozy of an interview. I'm telling you, this is going to be exciting and fun today. And subscribers, you must not fail. If you didn't hear Heather last year, and a lot of you are new now, thank God, go to the search engine, search Heather Lynn, and her interview from last year will come up about her previous book. And Heather, I can only say welcome to Dreamland, but first, let me give you a little background about Heather. She's a historian. She describes herself as a renegade archaeologist. I would say that's not quite right. I think that she's a conventional archaeologist, and the people who call themselves conventional archaeologists are the actual renegades because they won't look clearly in the direction of the truth. And that's the direction Heather has been trying to go and is in fact going. Her last interview, as I say, was absolute dynamite. So all I can do now is welcome Dr. Heather Lynn back to Dreamland. We're going to be talking about the Anunnaki connection, Sumerian gods, alien DNA, and the fate of humanity, not just what happened in the past, but what it means to us now, because there is an intimate connection between the rise of civilization and what's happening in the world right now. Welcome, Heather.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. I'm so excited to talk to you again and your listeners.
Well, great. Well, it's now what you've done here is it's similar in a way that what you did in the last book, in the sense that you've gathered together an absolutely amazing amount of evidence that there is something absolutely extraordinary happened in the past. There's so many ways into this. I was thinking, where do we start? And there's almost no place we can't start. So where I want to start is with the appearance of Sumerian civilization and why it was so sudden. And take us back to that era when Sumerian civilization actually flowered in Mesopotamia.
Well, it was really quite an amazing time. I mean, it was so long ago when you really think about, you know, the ancient texts that we have. If you can imagine a point where we had hunter-gatherer type bands of people who were loosely connected in a culture and they were semi-settled, and things were going great. They had their own technology that was, you know, pretty advanced. They had pottery and a lot of different things that brought them together. But, you know, before the Sumerians, during this kind of time where it was perhaps prehistoric for the most part, you don't have a permanent or organized settlement found in the archaeological record. You do now have hunter-gatherer sites that we know of, like Göbekli Tepe, which show a possible evidence of, say, feasting and dancing and celebrating and even spirituality. And, of course, everyone knows we have Stonehenge, which appears to have been a massive ritualistic meeting place of real importance. But it's different with the Sumerians than these sites. And, of course, we're probably going to learn all sorts of new things about Göbekli Tepe as time moves on and more research comes in. But something very important that differentiates the Sumerian culture from these other semi-settled sort of, you know, cultures, if you will, is that they had what archaeologists call and dub high culture. And it's a group of technical features that together constitute a academic, like, definition of civilization. And so that would be large urban centers, full-time specialist occupations, so careers as opposed to just duties or tasks or jobs, primary producers of food that give their surpluses to a ruler, so sort of the beginnings of a worshiping system, monumental architecture, monumental art, and importation of raw materials, a class structure with peasants, craftspeople, rulers, et cetera, and so many other things.
They even had, in the book you mentioned, dentistry, optometry, labor unions, mathematics. Yeah. They invented the time system of 60 for 60 minutes in time. They invented mathematics, astronomy, weights and measures, wheeled vehicles. It's an incredible list.
Libraries, even pills, something we would just take for granted, but the concept of a capsule where we'd take it and to have medicine. And they had all of these things, and not what you would call a primitive way either. That would be far too dismissive. These were actual structures and orthodoxies. They had university systems, and they were very similar to what we have now, where you would go through different degrees and unveiling different levels of knowledge and have to test, et cetera. Afterwards, you would, if you say were a doctor, you even had sort of malpractice insurance and different things you had to contend with. They were very big on bureaucracy and the written record. And so these inventions are clearly not just stone tools or any sort of, pottery pieces. These are very intellectual and most importantly, perhaps, teachable skills that are rooted in a deeper and more abstract or conceptual way of thinking. And I mean, this happened in almost an instant, really just, it's so amazing. And this is the most controversial part of this whole thing, is it is known as the Sumerian problem. And so the Sumerians don't fit into any major linguistic group, which has also made scholars kind of think that, well, maybe they're different, because all the other groups that were there previously, spoke a Semitic language, meaning it was a branch of the Afro-Asiatic language group originating in the Middle East. But then that must mean that the Sumerians came from somewhere else. And this is clearly spelled out in the mainstream literature. And again, it is called the Sumerian problem. And that problem is, how did this happen in the course of about 200 years? Where from one time we had, people basically in huts, to varying extent, to having astronomy and concepts of time and science and medicine and everything that would almost look like the modern world in many ways.
So, folks, let me give you a little perspective here. Go back to the year 1900. What was it like then? Well, we can tell very easily because we had photography. We have an elaborate civilization then. Now, go back to 200 years before the advent of Sumerian civilization in Mesopotamia. And what was it like? Well, Heather tells us there was nothing there. Mud huts, maybe. So then, 200 years later, what is there, Heather?
Huge buildings, sailboats, maps, wind power, philosophers, lawyers, economists, clergy, the wheel, universities, pills, almost anything you could imagine. All of the things that would just be very deeply conceptual and from a very high intelligence, technologically speaking. And so, I would not want to call the people before primitive, but in a lot of ways you have to, considering the great divide between what happened pre-Sumer and then what happened to make that group of people the Sumerian people with all of this vast technology. We're talking the fourth millennium BCE. It's so long ago.
So long ago, and yet there they are with all of this stuff just kind of coming out of nowhere. Now, Free Dreamlanders, we're going to take a little break. We're talking to Dr. Heather Lynn. Her new book, The Anunnaki Connection, Sumerian Gods, Alien DNA, and the Fate of Humanity. Well, in the third half hour, we're going to get into that issue of the fate of humanity. We'll be right back. As always, Dreamland's theme music is The O of Pleasure from Ray Lynch's beautiful album, Deep Breakfast, available at raylynch.com. My summer appearances are as follows. I will be at the Ozark Mountain UFO Conference, April 10 to 12, OzarkUFOConference.com, the McMinnville UFO Conference, May 14 to 16, that's UFOFest.com, at Contact in the Desert, May 28 to June the 1st, that's ContactInTheDesert.com, the Omega Institute, in July 17th to 20th, doing a course with Dr. Jeffrey Kreifel. That's eomega.org. Then I'll be back on the Pine Ridge Lakota Sioux Reservation, July 23 to 27, at the Thunderheart Center for the Arts in Wasta, South Dakota, at the Consciousness and Contact Conference. For questions and additional information, please contact Mia Ferroleto. That's MIA.FEROLETO@gmail.com. Last but not least by any means, I'll be at the Lilydale Assembly in upstate New York. That's the Assembly of the Spiritualist Church of America. You can find them at lilydaleassembly.org. That's August 28 to 29.
In 2015, Whitley Strieber entered a whole new level of contact, and his new book, A New World, tells the powerful and revealing story of what's been happening. Read about contact experiences unlike you have ever heard described before. Learn about the breakthroughs in communication that are developing right now. Experience the wonder of seeing into a mirror universe. The thrill of discovering the close encounter experience in an entirely new way. And learn the secret of how Whitley has built a very real and ongoing relationship with our otherworldly visitors. One Amazon reviewer says, a significant document of human empowerment. Another, one mind-bending, reality-shifting read. Another, outstanding. Get A New World today, available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold. And as an audiobook read by Whitley on Audible.com.
We're talking to Dr. Heather Lynn, the Anunnaki connection, Sumerian gods, alien DNA, and the fate of humanity. Her website is drheatherlynn.com. You can find her on Facebook at Dr. Heather Lynn, and you can find her book pretty well wherever books are sold. You can certainly get it on Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and IndieBound, the independent bookseller's book site. And obviously in your local bookstore, if you are lucky enough to still have one, if you do, patronize it. It's an important place in everybody's life, or should be. You can probably get it in your library as well. All right. Now, these people, they spring up out of nowhere. And I want to get into this question of how that might have happened. And I want to go there with a word that you bring up in the book, which I think is terribly important. The word mess, M-E-S-S. Mesopotamia is based on that word. What does it mean?
Oh, well, it's sort of based on that word. So it's a little complicated, in terms of the origin of that particular word pertaining to Mesopotamia itself. But in the tablet Enki and the World Order, the god Enlil collected a set of instructions that were intended for humans in these various cities that he had set up. And he handed them over to Enki, which is a really important part. Enki was like the Prometheus-type figure, the giver of knowledge. So Enlil hands them to Enki so that he may distribute these instructions. And the instructions themselves were called the maze, or mess. But the maze were official decrees of the gods that would be then the foundations to all of the attributes of this higher civilization. So in a way, they were like a law or instructions that guided the technologies and religious practices, social institutions, etiquette, everything you could think of, sort of like a social contract in a lot of way. But it is interesting that, you know, it is sort of the root of Mesopotamia, which means between two rivers. So the word literally means between. And these doctrines were binding because they came straight from the gods themselves and then were agreements between the gods and humankind. So they were, in a very literal sense, the first covenants between God and man. And so this Enlil, the spirit of Enlil, which is another important thing that I want to point out, is that some of these beings were spirits, some of them were physical, biological beings, some of them were semi-biological. And a lot of times that gets lost in the discussion.
Well, you know, but it's this, terribly interesting thing that you bring up, because that's exactly what we experience now. I experience exactly that. And if you go on my website, a lot of the close encounter witnesses on the website would say, yeah, I experience exactly the same thing. So
exactly.
Who are these people? Who were the Anunnaki?
Well, I mean, isn't that the million-dollar question, right? I mean, so many people have put in their theories about, you know, who they are and what they wanted and if they've been gone. And, you know, so in this book, what I've tried to do is to take a different approach, which is why I called it a connection, the Anunnaki connection, because you have a lot of different viewpoints, whether they be alternative or mainstream or however you would like to classify them. But what ends up happening is that you get sort of a cult of personality. You get a lot of this side, that side. And all of these views have what I believe to be an important positions and truths in them. But then everybody, it seems, want to gravitate to one idea. Well, let me give an example. When I announced the book was coming out, I had a reader ask me, so which position do you take? Do you take the humans were enslaved to mine gold, or the humans were enslaved to the agricultural workers' point of view? And I understood what they're saying. However, that's part of the thing that I'm trying to, you know, break, the paradigm I'm trying to break with this book, is that there's more than just even two ways of looking at this. And it is very important because it does reflect exactly what is going on right now. And so to me, after all the research that I've done and the research I present in the book, you know, I'm not going to say this is exactly the truth. I'm just going to say these are my thoughts based on, yes, considering all of the wonderful theories put out by researchers like Sitchin and, you know, Von Daniken and Edmund Marriage and, you know, so many people over the years that have contributed to this field of knowledge, including the naysayers, so to speak, like Michael Heiser or, you know, anybody like that. But then also my own research to other tablets that, you know, are often sort of less acknowledged or ignored. I believe that the Anunnaki were a group of advanced living beings who settled in a mountain valley in the Near East around 8200 BCE. And these people brought and shared technologies that were never before seen by other, say, hunter-gatherer humans in the regions, resettled after their homeland flooded. So I believe that the Anunnaki were a group of biological beings that were sort of antediluvian. Now, this is an important thing to consider, because the Anunnaki, the term itself, never meant just this one person or these 12 beings or three, or there are so many references, all of which are different. And they could be spirits, they could be biological, and again, semi-biological, and they are all considered Anunnaki. Over time, what you start seeing in the Sumerian text is that there becomes a distinction between the Anunnaki, the kings, and their appointed sage, which the sages, who were also considered Anunnaki, were different from the general Anunnaki. Those were sort of what I would consider interdimensional beings. They would advise the biological Anunnaki on different matters of legislation and rule, and so they were basically a hidden hand. Over time, though, I believe that the word Anunnaki started to pertain to the position of rulership in general. So like we would have Lord today, Lord Jesus or Lord, you know, Ganesha or any god you would call Lord. And then we also have a landlord or, you know, Lord of the Manor. And so I think that the term Anunnaki over many hundreds, if not thousands of years, as seen through the text, loses its specificity and becomes a placeholder for just a God-type figure in general, which I believe has contributed to the confusion about who the Anunnaki were altogether, meaning I believe that the Anunnaki were physical human beings. I also believe there's reason to not rule out that they had contact with other beings that were told were semi-biological, some of which were spiritual or interdimensional, and others are just simply a mystery. And so I believe that the story goes so far back that it is pre-written history, and some of it is oral tradition. I believe when it started to be written, it was the antediluvian people that escaped a cataclysm, sort of what some people would call the Civilization X theory. And I think these individuals kept alive their sacred knowledge of the arts and sciences after being displaced from a northern homeland more than 10,000 years ago. But over time, these scholars and scientists sort of shaped the lives of the Mesopotamian people and assumed leadership positions. And then those subsequent leaders claimed lineage to those people, those antediluvian sages, in order to maintain their legitimacy. And I think that where it gets a little maybe strange is that they had a mystery school type practice. It's very clearly written, and I discuss it in the book, all of the different things they had to go through to get their secret knowledge, which were the secrets of Enki. Part of this mystery practice included the ability to contact off-world entities that they believed to be non-human sages, who they considered Anunnaki as well. These sages would then guide the living rulers and serve as the hidden hand that would become a hierarchical bureaucratic government, which grew to be, in many ways, what I believe to be the model for all administrative social systems to come.
Including our own, because it involved things like a bicameral legislature.
Yes,
exactly.
Everything.
Free Dreamlanders, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to go back to that period, which we talked about just recently on Dreamland with Dr. Robert Schock, when something happened about 10 or 12,000 years ago. Heather has mentioned 8,400 or 8,500 BC. We'll find out more about that when we get back.
Support UnknownCountry.com and its great mission to make contact happen. Use our vast archive of interviews, meditations, commentaries, news, and Whitley Strieber audiobooks to expand your mind and your understanding of close encounter. Meet others who have similar interests on our active free message board or in our subscriber comments and Wednesday night chats. There is no other site like Unknown Country in or out of this world. Go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe today.
We're talking to Dr. Heather Lynn. Her new book, The Anunnaki Connection, Sumerian Gods, Alien DNA, and the Fate of Humanity. Where are we going? Well, in the third half hour, we're going to explore that question very deeply and in some very new ways. But right now, Heather, let's go back to this appearance of these people in a mountain valley so very long ago. What happened? Who were they?
Well, in a study published in the Journal of Global and Planetary Change, they found that sea levels rose an average of about 3 feet per century at the end of the last ice age. They had sort of intermittent periods of increase to 8 feet per century. So kind of, you know, wax and wane, but it was ultimately just flooding. You know, and this process lasted about 6,000 years until the Ubaid period, which was 6,500 to 3,800 BCE. And that is the Ubaid period, is that culture that in a way is like the Celt, where it wasn't one people specifically, but they were united in the sense that they have similar pottery and there's not a lot known about them. So this all of the sea level rising lasted up until that period. And then that is when, you know, the ancient Sumerian city-state of Ur was originally settled. And at that time, the Persian Gulf's water level was much higher than it is today. And so in addition to the change in landscape, the climate became warm and wet, and that made dense forests grow and, a beautiful region that was just fertile in every way, and it was known as the Fertile Crescent as a result. It became home to many prehistoric people. And so this general area known as Mesopotamia, is where we find a lot of this amazing growth, but it really happened after the heels of, the Ice Age. So I think that's an important thing to consider. And another thing, when you look at the textual evidence of what the people who came, it was written from a perspective of, say, the people, I'll call them the pre-flood people just for now, or Civilization X to be fun. This group of people, they came down to Mesopotamia and they saw all these other people. Well, they referred to them as the black-headed people. And that is referred to all throughout many, many different texts. And I think it's very important because if you have black hair and I have black hair and everyone else has black hair, it wouldn't seem logical that I would try to make a distinction between myself and everybody else if we all had black hair. So it would seem to indicate that those who came from that area did not have black hair. So they were genetically different somehow. They came and they referred to these people as the black-headed ones, meaning that they have black hair. And you see that all over. So another thing that you see that is strange is the use of the word Adam or Adama. They not only referred to the people that they came across there as the black-headed people, they refer to them as the Adama. And there are a lot of different arguments as to what that actually meant. But the Adama, in my estimation, refers to the red people. And so that sounds really strange. Like, well, were they red? How would they be red? But interestingly enough, there has been archaeological evidence to show that there's a special kind of ochre in that region that people had probably put on their bodies in some sort of decorative way or, body adornment, because they did actually use them on the skeletal remains of people. And so if you could imagine a world where these other people came to escape their flooded homeland and they found a group of black-haired people who painted themselves with ochre, and they didn't speak the same language, and they also came with this amazing technology and this different knowledge. Well, they forced the individuals who they thought were, different. I mean, this is kind of a common thing that happens through human behavior, is they subjugated the individuals and they made them worship, which in the Hebrew translation, the word worship actually means work for. And so they made them work for them. And so they did put them in, labor roles in agriculture and construction, and they made sure to keep them sort of ignorant and, because knowledge is power. And so, if you consider this small group of people that came in and looked so different to the surrounding clans and groups, it would be amazing and awe-inspiring that they were, not only different looking, but probably larger in size, hence the whole argument for them being giants, because generally speaking, the hunter-gatherer societies were much shorter than those who were coming from an agricultural region where they would have had, better protein and more access to foods. So I think what we see here is this, antediluvian meeting of the bands of people. And yes, it is that sort of enslavement for agricultural sense. But I think where most of those theories fail to really, push the envelope further is that they don't explain how did the antediluvian people, the people who fled their homeland, how did they have the knowledge that they had? Who were they talking to? What was their belief set and practices? And we have a lot of those answers because they were recorded from oral tradition, but then recorded in the Sumerian text, which is why we have this sort of clash of different types of Anunnaki from an ancient time moving on up through, even into Babylon in a lot of ways. And we see them like syncretize into recognizable figures like the gods of Olympus, but there was something way beyond that.
Well, you know, I think it's a perfect time to take a brief break for our free Dreamlanders, which we're going to do. We're talking to Dr. Heather Lynn, the Anunnaki Connection, Sumerian Gods, Alien DNA, and the Fate of Humanity. And when we get back, we're going to be talking about the way beyond that, because we're going to get into just who these people were, these otherworlders, if you want to call them that, were, where they came from, and what the old texts actually tell us, instead of assuming that those texts don't fit our expectations and therefore they must be just the silly work of a bunch of primitives. We're going to take them seriously and say to ourselves, well, maybe these people who wrote these texts, who had, after all, invented civilization, weren't so stupid. We'll be right back.
Notice anything unusual about Unknown Country? When you land on the site, you don't see ads about things you've bought or things some data miner thinks you might like. Why not? Because when you come to Unknown Country, your visit is private. We don't use data miners. We don't report to them. When you come here, we leave you alone, which is as it should be everywhere. Another thing you don't see are video ads that start when you least expect it, pop-ups that interfere with your reading, clutter that distracts you. What do you see? Stories that go in depth, that see beyond where the general media will take you, but don't seek to confuse you with sensation and hoaxes. Plus, a gigantic news archive that's easily searchable with our powerful search engine and entirely free. Unknown Country, the internet as it ought to be, the truth that others will not tell you. Want to keep it coming? Join us today. Click on the subscribe tab on the masthead and get started. Unknown Country needs you, and you need us.
The Afterlife Revolution is getting great reviews. There's a tremendous, lovely response to it, and I'm so pleased and humbled, because it's an effort on the part of myself and Anne. And I love Anne so much. I want her to succeed in this incredible task that she has undertaken of returning and communicating across the bridge between the worlds. And she's really doing it. This is a real thing that's happening. Listen to some of these reviews. Anne and Whitley Strieber lay out their life's work in the most exquisitely beautiful manner. This moving book comes from the heart, the unified heart of two people who have dedicated their lives in this realm and the next to revealing the nature of consciousness as it makes its sojourn in this human form. That's just one. Here's another. I love, love this book. It's a wonderful read, especially if you lost somebody very close to you. Just incredible. Here's another one. The book shows you how to grow your soul, for lack of a better term. Through Anne's insight, Whitley shares invaluable information that could only be from the other side. So take it seriously. Go to Amazon and get Afterlife Revolution. The Afterlife Revolution is available on Amazon.com as an audiobook, a Kindle, or a paperback. I read the audiobook myself. You can also find it on Audible.com. And if you have questions or thoughts, write me at whitley@striever.com. I'm right here. I'm ready to answer anything you ask to help you in any way I can, always.
Did you know that pet dogs are routinely stolen from their homes in Thailand and smuggled to Vietnam under atrocious conditions and then slaughtered for food? Worse, the slaughter is brutal because it's believed that it makes the meat taste better. Of course, there are many larger problems in the world, but not to these dogs, and the Soy Dog Foundation is there to help them. Dog has given man everything he has to give, heart, soul, body, and mind. When he calls to us in need, we have to answer. Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the Soy Dog Foundation ad on the left side of the homepage. A $10 gift today can save a dog from this terrible suffering tomorrow. Unknown Country and Whitley Strieber receive no compensation from the Soy Dog Foundation.
We're talking to Dr. Heather Lynn, The Anunnaki Connection, Sumerian Gods, Alien DNA, and the Fate of Humanity. In the third half hour, we're going to get into that very issue of us and where we are going, because we are at a crossroads right now. Make no mistake about it. Dr. Lynn's website is drheatherlynn.com. You can find her on Facebook as well at Dr. Heather Lynn. Heather, what do the texts, old texts, actually tell us about what was going on and who these people were?
They tell us quite a lot. And since a lot of it was recorded over and over again, it can begin to be like a game of telephone where maybe one little word is altered in just such a way that it does alter the meaning altogether. And so if you go back and think about this scenario where you have these sages, these otherworldly type figures that guided the rulers, the power these beings had just inflated their egos, and then a clash of culture combined with this sort of enslavement of the Adama and the priest class that emerged to sort of be the go-between, all of these different structures started to create a lot of stress and problems. And also the text seemed to point to the notion that the Anunnaki were banned from, mingling, co-mingling with these regular people, which is where you get this idea of Nephilim and things to come about, which I cover, more in depth in the book. But these enslaved people working in the garden would eventually find mercy in one of those elite figures, and that would be Enki. And that Promethean figure, Enki, in the text, clearly he breaks with his class of people, and he rebelled, and he taught the Adama these sacred arts and technologies. And, after breaking with his own people and giving these different people, the Adama, forbidden knowledge, the rebel gods around Enki started to assimilate and then just be absorbed into the local culture. And then their offspring were literally demonized, in my opinion. And over time, I think this is the story of how humanity was brought out of the wild and organized into civilizations in a way, but that those gods would be celestialized, mythologized, and even demonized after so many rewritings and revising of these tablets. These other kind of worldly beings that are sometimes discussed and sometimes not, the original text, when they are telling us that, the kings of Sumer had a very educated scribal advisor assigned to them, I don't think it should be neglected. We see these words exactly so. And I include those in the book so people can see for themselves what the texts say. And it says that these advisors would transmit the knowledge they received from supernatural beings to the ruler so that he could be a builder. And those are the words, the builder of his kingdom. And so using the supernatural plans, Sumerian rulers were able to accomplish the huge feats of engineering and planning and technology and advancement, leading to all of the progress seen throughout the ancient world, arguably. And, it might sound a little far-fetched, but it's really not the first time this framework could be seen in the history of the ruling class. I mean, we find this in Enochian magic, and we find this sort of maybe framework or structure all over the place. And today, there's still this kind of social stratification and exploitation of labor and manipulation of the masses and even the mystery traditions. People still contact or at least believe they are in contact with these same, in my opinion, the same semi-biological entities from a different dimension, so to speak. I mean, they may be now what people call the machine elves or the clockwork elves that they encounter when they do DMT or similar molecules, but I believe they're really the same. I think they are the seven sages. I think they're the archons of the Gnostic, the serpent gods of the Far East and Central America, the titans of the Greeks, the snake brothers of the Hopi, the jinn of Islam, the demons of Christianity, the Elohim. I mean, all of these words, I believe, we're speaking of the same phenomena through this.
And that, the aliens of today, I think.
I think you're right.
I think so, too. I think that's this is an ancient part of the life of Earth, of the planet, that we have been in. We're not just getting into contact. We're realizing this presence that is here again. We're reconnecting with it after thousands of years is what's happening, I think.
I think you're spot on, as usual. you have that insight. But, you know, I think these are the watchers. They are watching. They have been. And they are still here.
And we're at a point in our history when there is good reason for them to reemerge. And we will be talking about that, as I said, in the third half hour. But right now, there is an elephant in this living room, and it's a guy. I knew him. You knew him. He was in many ways a wonderful, if difficult, man. His name was Zechariah Sitchin. And in his book, The 12th Planet, which I read many years ago, and I'm sure most of my listeners have read it, and you probably, I'm sure you, I know you've read it, he contends that the texts, the Sumerian texts, were mistranslated and were accounts of ancient extraterrestrial contact. Now, where are we with his translations now and his theories?
What I think has gone on is actually quite a shame. And I think, you know, this may be presumptuous to say, but I'm going to say it. I think Sitchin himself would be disappointed in the direction his work has taken after he's been gone, taken by others, not him, obviously, and not the people who have really, you know, held his work to be as important as it was. I think what has gone on is that if you consider when he came out with his work and theories, it was, you know, quite a while ago, many decades ago. And he came out, asserted his thesis, and, you know, obviously scholars discounted his interpretations and deemed as pseudoscience and all these other words they love to use. But he had passion and dedication, and he really brought these stories and myths and texts to the forefront. It was a long time ago, and I believe that because his theories were so groundbreaking and so fascinating, and so different than what anyone had done before, really, that people have focused so much on that, and then it's been sort of like suspended in time and like just where nobody has gone on. I mean, there has been. I don't want to be hyperbolic and say nobody. There have been researchers who have gone on and tried to continue the work and look more deeply into this. But the problem is they're always faced with this, so is Sitchin right or Sitchin wrong, as opposed to let's add to the breadth of knowledge. Let's open the door wider. I look at Sitchin as someone who opened the door halfway, but that door needs to be opened wide. And we can't do that if we're just always focusing on, you know, this text or where he got this wrong or that. And I think that it's a shame, really. And as a result, people have had to be pushed to one side or another, so to speak. And then that really doesn't help us transcend and get closer to the actual truth. And so I'm not going to say, oh, he was right on everything. He wasn't. He simply wasn't. He would have admitted that. I mean, he did this work, and it's okay to be wrong about things. Einstein said, anyone who has never made a mistake has never tried anything new. And I think that's the most important thing here, is that the orthodoxy now in academia, and even unfortunately you see it creeping into, say, the alternative world, is that you must never go out of this narrative. And if you do something new, you know, it's scary, but that's how we find amazing things. You have to be willing to take that leap, to take a risk, and to just go out there and say what you think, and let other people then build on that or reshape that or however. Basically, we need to make the connections. We need to not just get rid of all that information. And we also need to not say, okay, this was 100% biblically true And, you know, it can never be denied. I think that also keeps us in that state of suspended animation, and we won't grow together. And all it does is it creates this division between, well, is this person right or is that person right? And I think at the end of the day, we in the alternative community are sort of doing what we complain that the mainstream does. We're starting to be very closed-minded. And so in my humble attempt in this book, I try to take that different approach and say, let's look at all of this and synthesize some of this together and add new information, because there is a lot of new information. There's new text being analyzed every single day, and many of them by, yes, mainstream researchers, but they're not doing this in a way to try to control a narrative. It's just generic data analysis, and anybody can go get this information. And I would just encourage everybody who's interested in this to definitely read Sitchin, definitely read von Daniken, read everything you can, but keep reading. Don't stop there, and read newer work, and keep it going. And someday we're going to stand on the shoulders of those giants and really reach the truth.
And the truth, I think, is going to be pretty surprising and pretty different from what we have put together for ourselves. For example, the entities and whatever they are, whether they are at times at least physical presences or not in our world, without addressing that, something happened in the deep past, and there was a disconnect of some kind. But I want to go even deeper. In the book, in the section called Primordial Beginnings, you really inspired my imagination when you began to discuss the Phanerozoic eon, the entire span that complex life has existed on Earth's surface. And I realized, my God, an advanced civilization could easily have risen and then disappeared entirely in that period. And maybe it's what we see now, these strange beings that will enter our lives from time to time, as they did during the creation of Sumerian civilization, as they appear to be doing again, maybe they come from somewhere very distant in Earth's own past. Could that? Is there any substance in that? Any reason to speculate?
I think there's plenty of reason, not only to speculate, but and I think NASA and Cornell University did more than speculate. They actually researched this question to a certain extent. They researched the question of the possibility of an undetectable ancient industrial civilization in a paper they put out called the Silurian Hypothesis. It was named after the intelligent race of reptilians from the show Doctor Who, interestingly enough. What they were looking for was, could they find if there was an industrial civilization in the geological record? And what they found this is amazing that they would even be looking at this. This was NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies and the University of Rochester. It was published by Cornell, so this was definitely some mainstream work here. They asked whether humans were not the only advanced civilization that could have been on our planet at some point. And so what they thought was, well, if we take the Drake equation and sort of alter it a little, and, you know, the Drake equation is used to estimate the number of active communicative extraterrestrial civilizations in the Milky Way. And so, you know, it is highly theoretical, but it's pretty sound. And so they used it as a model. The study claimed that since the fossil record doesn't really go back further than 2.6 million years, that we really couldn't know for sure, detect in any way, that if there was some sort of ancient civilization, because anything earlier than that would have just turned to dust by now. And so that question still is relevant. What if there was something before that time period? And so they use the Drake equation. To get in the weeds on it, everybody can read in the book and look at the equation, you know, for themselves. But basically, they use the mathematical model and determine that if ancient civilizations went to space and left artifacts on other planets, it would be easier to find the evidence of these civilizations than it would be even on Earth, because of the erosion and tectonic activity that would just erase evidence of any extremely antiquated civilization. And so they did this in a way to, well, as they say, try to determine whether or not they could detect the possibility of advanced extraterrestrial life. So if they could figure out whether or not we had life here before in the geological record, given that the fossil record wouldn't support it, could they find a way to model that out? If they can, then that means that when they go to different planets, presumably, they would be able to use that same model to determine if there was ever very ancient life there. You know, and so it's just interesting because while it is very hypothetical and very out there in a lot of ways, it just shows that there is reason to not only speculate, but actually research and try to figure out, you know, could there have been life not only here on this planet, but even other planets so far back that our current measurements and scientific, you know, technologies wouldn't be able to really confirm their existence. And so it's, you know, it's definitely worth consideration.
Well, yeah. And, you know, one of the things that I was fascinated by when I was years ago was the face on Mars that was the image that was made by the Viking orbiter. And NASA insisted it was just a pile of rocks. And an expert, Dr. Mark Carlotto, analyzed it, and he eventually published in the IEEE journal an analysis showing that it couldn't be that it was something constructed. But then when we got closer looks at it, it had been radically altered, like someone had destroyed it. And I wrote Dr. Carlotto at the time and said, "What gives?" And he wrote me back after a while saying there are numerous signs of movement. In other words, this has been destroyed. Somebody, before we could take a really close look at it, somebody scrambled it so that it would look like exactly what NASA claimed it was, just a random pile of rocks. Now, that's one thing in this solar system that could be an artifact of the very, very distant past, because it must have been extremely old, that was intentionally hidden by somebody who is still here and does not wish us to know that. I know why they don't wish us to know that. They've explained that to me very clearly. And I'm going to start the third half hour by just laying that out so that we get past the whole idea of government secrecy and so forth, and into the deeper secrecy that's much more real and much more profoundly important to understand. But before we go to our last 15 minutes of this part of Dreamland, we're going to be talking about Nibiru. We're going to take a little break, free Dreamlanders.
The new unknown country is here, and it has so much to offer. Our huge archive of Dreamland, plus the full run of William Henry's revelations, Anne Streber's mysterious powers and her incredible contactee interviews, Whitley's Communion, Secret School, Transformation, and Majestic ebooks, his powerful meditations, and so much more. Plus every week, the full subscriber versions of Whitley's Dreamland, Mike Clellan's The Unseen, and monthly, Jeremy Vaney's The Experience. We offer subscriptions either by credit card or PayPal, either automatic renewal or annual or longer subscriptions without auto-renew. Plus, it's easy to cancel if you wish. Do it right in your account. Plus, a live chat every week on Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Pacific, and so much more. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and subscribe. Keep this incredible site going and have a great time doing it.
UnknownCountry.com subscribers have access to a vast treasury of information. Listen to what Dr. Robert Schock said. He's an expert on the past, and for that reason, he also knows a great deal about the future.
We are re-entering, as you say, a debris field. And when you have a debris field like this, it enters the solar system. It energizes the solar system as you have things going into the sun. Even clouds of dust particles, for instance, it will energize the sun. It will destabilize the sun. This is what we saw at the end of the last ice age. In approximate terms, about 13,000 years ago.
And just in the past few days, more enormous meteors have been sighted, and this goes on continuously, more and more every year. We live in a time of great change in a world that doesn't like to look at things as they are. UnknownCountry.com offers extraordinary information, a vast archive that you cannot find anywhere else. Subscribe today. Help keep this website going, because without you, there is and can be no us. Go to UnknownCountry.com. Right now, click on the subscribe tab. Get started.
We're talking to Dr. Heather Lynn. Her book, The Anunnaki Connection, Sumerian Gods, Alien DNA, and the Fate of Humanity. Her website, drheatherlynn.com, and you can reach her on Facebook at Dr. Heather Lynn. Okay, now, let's talk a little bit about the cosmology of people like Emanuel Velikovsky, whose theories, despite their being furiously debunked, have proved to have some surprising strength, and the theories of Zechariah Sitchin also. The theories of Eric von Daniken. These outsiders, outliers, have something. What is it exactly, do you think? I think it revolves mostly around the function and presence of the planet Nibiru and the possibility that we live in a double star system, which has been studied by very extensively by Walter Cruttenden. We've had him on Dreamland. So let's talk about the structure of cosmology as you see it.
Well, the Sumerians were quite adept at astronomy and even astrology before, you know, it wasn't separate back when they were inventing this or discovering it, depending on how you look at it. They had, zodiac and all of these things. So they really knew what was going on. And it's becoming more and more clear all the time how much they actually knew. Just when we think that they couldn't have understand, say, like geometry or this particular transit of a planet, we find out, no, they did. So every day we're still learning how much they actually knew. And so Nibiru is one of these things where it is really controversial because it is actually rarely cited in the tablets. It's fragmentary at best, and it's often related to the god Marduk. And so that gives rise to so many different possibilities for interpretation. But astronomical associations are even more complicated by the fact that because of equinoxes, you know, the arrangement of stars in the sky are different than in modernity. So there's so many different ways to look at this. And the difficult thing is that there's only just a handful of these texts that even truly cite Nibiru. According to one hypothesis, Nibiru can be translated as a crossing point, which divides not the horizon, but the celestial equator. And so Tiamat then is the Milky Way, or the dark stripe in the middle. And Nibiru then is located on the Milky Way. And that's, you know, one way to look at it. So if we consider Nibiru then to be an astronomical body, the other difficulty is that there are already reconstructed lists of stars that the Sumerians had, and we still have those. And so celestial objects that may be similar to Nibiru have already been sort of mentioned in these lists separately as different objects. And so it creates this sort of like you know, confusion and disagreement. And so it doesn't help the ancients then divided the sky into several paths that were associated with main gods. And so there's so much saying that perhaps Nibiru was, you know, located on the path of the god Anu and associated with the planet Jupiter. And this is something you see, you know, a lot where they think maybe Nibiru was Jupiter. There's also a mention of it being associated with Mercury. So, you know, a lot of researchers consider Nibiru to have been Jupiter, although this is contrary to the list that the Sumerians have themselves. It's very difficult to pin down what Nibiru is. There's also a hypothesis connecting Nibiru with the star Sirius, you know, the brightest star of the night sky. In one instance, Nibiru is described separately from the planets and stars, and this description has Nibiru sort of fixed in the center of the, quote, 12 starry months, which would allow the concept of Nibiru to be a fixed point on the axis of the world, or, you know, an axis of the celestial sphere. I mean, it's so many things. And then, of course, that's beyond the myth. And so that's one of the reasons they don't discount a lot of theories, because, you know, I list in the book so many different explanations that, you know, are common and some that are not typical. One of them is pretty common now, which is that the Nibiru is planet X, whose orbit, you know, according to Sitchin, crossed the solar system between Mars and Jupiter once every 3,600 years. You know, and so Sitchin claimed that Nibiru was described in the Sumerian text as the 12th planet, and that's, you know, what he named his book after. And this was the planet where Sitchin believed the Anunnaki once lived, and theorized that that planet would go rogue and zoom past Earth and cause a great catastrophe, you know, because of the gravitational pull, and which is sort of reminiscent of, you know, the Velikovsky's planetary collision framework. And so they are very similar.
Yes.
And so it is fascinating to see this. And one of the tablets that is most pointed to prove, so to speak, that this Nibiru was that planet is the VA 243, which I look at in the book a little more closely. It depicts, you know, if you choose to go with Sitchin's hypothesis, it shows the entire cosmos or solar system, and it points to Nibiru as well. But there's a lot of different ways to look at that, as you know, in addition to Sitchin's way. And so I think if you examine the newer Akkadian spelling of Nibiru as N-E-B-E-R-U, it means to cross over. But then sometimes it is Nibiri, which also means a ferryman, as in the one you may need if you were crossing over when you break the word apart.
Very interesting, too, that we, in the later ancient world, began to think of the ferryman as that, as the one who took us across the River Styx from this life to another.
Imagine that.
Yeah, exactly. And you're talking to somebody who spent days last summer in a situation where, when I closed my eyes, I saw another world, another Earth, very similar to this one, almost like a mirror version of it, which I described in my book, A New World, folks. If you haven't read it, it's a chapter called The Fields of Asphodel. And so I have to ask you, what about that possibility that we are looking not necessarily at something that is like a planet in our own universe, but at an interaction with another world, another Earth that is like a parallel universe or a mirror world?
That is a fascinating way to look at it, and it could quite possibly be, given the vagueness of the text. And a lot of this has crossover meaning, too, when they would talk about, you know, these planetary connections between gods, which also then had connections to a spiritual realm, as also the natural world in terms of, you know, astronomical events and agricultural events or weather, climate, or things. So it was very connected as a as above, so below kind of system. So nothing was really separate. It was only much later with, you know, this deconstruction aspect of science that we've gone through, and we've taken things away from their holistic centers, where I mentioned before there was once, you know, not a division between astronomy and astrology. And now, of course, there is. And, you know, there's a division between faith and reason. And, you know, everything's divided in mind and body. And I think in the ancient world, they were much more holistic about their approach to things, which is why I believe that it's so difficult for most of us in the contemporary world to look at those ancient texts and not, you know, see it in the way that it was originally meant. I think we apply our own sort of divisive nature to it and try to really pick out those hard meanings and not maybe realize that it could have had, you know, like an onion, layers and layers of important meanings that held this deeper truth inside.
And we have a situation now where the Enlightenment, what has it did was it cut off what we now, I think, inappropriately see as the spiritual side. It divided all of these things, such as alchemy and chemistry, is a perfect example. Mm-hmm. The one flows out of the other, and they have interlocking meanings. And when you cut one off from the other, you lose the sense of both.
Very well said.
Yeah. As a result, chemistry becomes entirely mechanical, and alchemy seems to lose all meaning. And yet,
absolutely.
That's very far from the truth. So where are you right now? Were the Anunnaki people from another world, at least in part, another physical world?
I believe that the Anunnaki was such a vast group of beings that I believe that in what would constitute the Anunnaki, you have spirit beings, biological beings, human beings that were quite advanced and different, and you have semi-biological beings, and I think these otherworldly beings, I mean, I really couldn't say whether they came from a particular planet. I mean, you could use your imagination and read those texts and really see that that was what they were saying, or you could think about how other mythologies and other belief sets also had those same ideas, but describe them more of existing in the shaman realm.
Right.
So it's, in my opinion, when we say other world, I don't necessarily vibe with the late 50s metal technology of rocket ships and this sort of thing. I think that for me, what seems to emerge over and over again is a pattern, not only in the ancient Near East mythos, but what just keeps on happening over and over again is that these were interdimensional beings, that make them very real, make them different than spirit, but also it explains how there is such thing as spirit, and that maybe perhaps they can shift that form at will, so it doesn't have to be just, you know, something from a different dimension, that, you know, perhaps that's why they can become semi-biological and even biological. But I think there's more to it, and it's just the tip of the iceberg, and more research is certainly needed.
Well, you know, you're talking to someone who's actually seen this with his own eyes. I've seen and lived with and worked with people who could be biological or balls of light or simply completely invisible. So to me, it's quite real. Now, we come to the third half hour. In the third half hour, I'm going to start by explaining very clearly what I've recently learned from what I call the visitors about the reason for the secrecy. Then we're going to go on. We're going to talk about the Nibiru and Armageddon and what may be happening in our world. And then the profound, deep cover-up that surrounds all of this material, because somebody, not on the outside, but somebody inside the secret world, does know a lot that they ain't telling us. Free Dreamlanders, thank you so much for staying with us, and I hope I have piqued your curiosity enough for you to go over to Unknown Country and at last subscribe and really begin to dig in to this wonderful treasury of information. We've been talking to Dr. Heather Lynn, her new book, The Anunnaki Connection, Sumerian Gods, Alien DNA, and the Fate of Humanity. She can be reached at drheatherlynn.com, and she's on Facebook as Dr. Heather Lynn. Her book is available anywhere, and it's a really good book. I really have, obviously, I mean, you can hear I've gotten deeply into this. So, Free Dreamlanders, again, thank you very much for being with us.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.